You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of The Undertow by Jeff Charlotte. Hillary, we learn, has secretly already been executed. You've seen her since? Green screens. There are, we learn, two United States, the one that lives in our hearts and the wicked one in Washington. Trump's not only still president of the real one, he's the 19th president, because most of the others since Lincoln, including Honest Abe, were illegal. Will straight lose them here? No, straight's in the word, which is like speaking in tongues, based not on reason, but on the faith that there's meaning even in, especially in, that which at first seems strange. Trump, straight coos, is the commander-in-chief of the military right now. Yes, Lord, he has not turned over the football. The nuclear codes, that's right, says the congregation, amen. Such are the spiritual truths of the Trumpocene, which didn't end January 20th, 2021. A fringe that surrounds the center and moves inward until suddenly there it is, the fringe at the heart of things. The QAnon shaman in the Senate chamber, or Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Ashley Babbitt, who died empty-handed, or Representative Lauren Boebert, who open carries, the zip-tie guy, or Jenny Thomas, who helped plan that awful day in Washington. Straight doesn't mention Ashley, but I understand now why Richard at the rally urged me to come this evening. I really am learning what Ashley knew, the Trump dream. All I dream about and pray for, she wrote. It is all connected, the pedos and the enslaved. You can't sell your soul to the devil without a price. She retweeted the price deep state traitors will pay, death by firing squad. She'd come to care deeply for the 800,000 children she incorrectly believed are stolen every year. She spoke with hurtling indignation about immigration and drugs. She experienced her anger as love, channeled it into belief, embraced the authority of her president, Redeemer. She embraced authority, full stop, as the fundamental frame for knowing the world. Straight preaches at length on maritime law, about how legally we are all vessels, subject to the same regulations as ports and pursers, the ship's officer in charge of money. Purser, person. It's all right there for those with ears to hear. With each term, he reveals secret etymologies, deep rabbit holes, the winding path on which straight has come from Trump to lead us, will restore to us, we the people, command of our own ships, our vessels, our bodies. We learn that by signing our birth certificates, our mothers unwittingly made us slaves. Yes, slaves. It goes back to the 14th Amendment. You may think that's the one that ensured the rights of formerly enslaved people, equal protection of the laws. That's what they want you to think. It's not your fault, Strait says. You were fed fake news. Critical race theory. You don't know that the 14th Amendment made you, true American you, a slave. What Strait's doing isn't so simple as rhetorically waving a Confederate flag, even if it amounts to much the same. Straight swaddles the myth of the lost cause in universalism. For the modern right, Reconstruction, the uneven attempt to enforce those equal protections, is the root of big government. People you can't see, in places you haven't been, having a say in how you live your life. See, preaches Strait, in Genesis 1:26 through 28, God gave me, man, dominion over the land, the air, and the water, and everything therein, and this is law. Amens ripple through the sanctuary. The law, says Strait, tells us we're not citizens, but kings. God is our King of Kings, says Strait. He ain't the King of Slaves. There's world building here, much like the imaginary past summed up in Ashley Babbitt's use of a date, 1776, the year itself like the Holy Ghost. There was the Gospel of the Father, which Christians call the Old Testament, and the Gospel of the Son, which they call the New. And now comes a Gospel of 1776, apotheosis of revenge and redemption. We chant 1776 because it reminds us of revolting against our government, said another insurrectionist, naming the date as a kind of kairos, a New Testament word for time out of time, God's appointed hour. As history, it's bunk. As politics, fascist kitsch. But as desire, longing, the wish to live in the moment, to enter the myth as the hero of your own story. Mask-free autonomous zone, read a poster on the front door of Ashley's pool cleaning business, better known as America, a place of men who smile, laugh, shout, and have a damn good time. You can either be a 100% citizen being protected by your civil rights, Strait proposes, a slave, or you can be 100% sovereign, protected by your unalienable rights given you by God. A white man in spirit, if not in fact. Strait's a partisan of the growing sovereign citizen movement, which holds that federal government has no authority. He replaces citizen with national, but the concept's the same. Just as an essence is the broader ideology of states' rights, expressed by governors in Texas and Florida. When they stand in the door to block federal laws, so too does this ethos animate those who stormed the Capitol. If you guys get indicted, like some of us did on January 6th, says Strait, then he interrupts himself, because in his mind he is sovereign. Not me, of course. I'm a king. I'm free. You can't touch me. After Strait's sermon, I meet Pastor Dave. What are the odds, I ask, that I'd fly across the country to attend a rally for Ashley and find myself at this church in the country learning the theology of her cause? Dave laughs. Did you know that in the language of Scripture there's no word for coincidence in either the Old Testament or the New? Coincidence is just a spectacular thing, that God remains anonymous. Take COVID-19. Dave says Scripture teaches that what your enemies, China, Fauci, intend as evil, God makes good. Isn't that the meaning of Christ? Murdered by the deep state of his day, then risen to conquer it? The meaning of every martyr. But what about the dead who don't rise, I ask? Not Jesus, not Ashley, the million lost to COVID. COVID is real, and the dead are many, Dave allows. But there's a good part. God has spoken. Those who truly want to represent me, please stand up. Dave says there will be trials and hangings for those who don't. Strait's testimony of Hillary's execution gives him hope, he says. Now we know who's standing, who's not, and who in the coming war will dangle. 4. Inland. Or maybe here's the good part. There is a word for coincidence in the Bible, Seth Sanders, author of The Invention of Hebrew, tells me, the root and associated noun are fairly frequently used and mean to encounter by chance. He adds a dig at Dave. This is not something that someone well-versed in Hebrew would say. It's satisfying when an expert flattens a false claim. That's how so many of us believe we'll resist the undertow of civil war, fact-checking our way back to solid ground. But much like the cross for Pastor Dave, such corrections miss the point. You can't fact-check a myth. How to say, then, that Ashley Babbitt is not a martyr? There's the word itself, martyr, which means witness, one's life given as testament to some larger truth. The story for which she put herself in front of the gun, that the election was stolen, verifiably false. But what if she died as a witness not to fact, but to dream? Through a glass darkly, the comfort of chaos, the relief of issues falling away, like a body letting go, falling backward, into conflict itself as the cause, never ending. How do you disprove that? From Yuba City, I turn inward, toward the center. I drive over Donner Pass the next night, listening to talk radio rise and fall according to the ridgeline. First-time caller defending the AR-15. It's our heritage. Flip the dial. Kenny Loggins, danger zone. Be safe, Aaron Babbitt, Ashley's husband, texted her as she prepared to fly to Washington the day before the insurrection. I cannot lose you. Ashley was headed toward the front lines. She responded from the plane, not as wife or lover, but as soldier. Tons of Trump supporters on my plane. She was posting a lot of selfie videos by then, in her kitchen, driving to work. There's riots, there's arrest, there's rapes, she says. I am so tired of it, she says. She's 15 minutes from the border. Thousands of people on the other side, she warns. They're coming. She's ready. She's a digital soldier. She's a real soldier. She's going to take it. IRL. She wasn't crazy. Her ideas were, but she wasn't insane. She was mad. So what? White rage is close cousin to white tears, to which many quite reasonably say, get over yourself. And yet, if sorrow and anger are shaped by race, they're not products of it alone. How much of Ashley's anger was rooted in her experience as a woman, as seemingly queer in practice, if not in name? How much had been formed by her frustrated Air Force career? Did her failed first marriage play a role? How much was linked to her struggling business's debt? A court judgment against it for $71,000, an ill-considered short-term loan charging interest she calculated at 169%. She liked to say she was living the American dream, but her anger dislodged her from one dream and propelled her into another. A red dream cascading into the Capitol and almost through that window. Her death itself became the dream of others. Consider Garrett Miller of Dallas. When the FBI came to his door, they found him wearing a T-shirt that declared, I was there, Washington, D.C., January 6, 2021. It was Ashley who led to his arrest. A beautiful soul, he wrote online. They murdered a child. Then he found out about Lieutenant Michael Byrd, the black officer who shot her. Miller debated execution methods. He settled on a noose. She fought for me, he wrote. Now I fight for her. It feels drier here inland. Record heat wave, says the radio. The sky darkens. Smoke, not rain. I'm driving through fire, detoured onto leaner roads. I pause to watch flames lick over a ridge, flickering down to the black ribbon on which I stand. The smoke isn't just black and orange, but green, sometimes purple. The sun peers through, copper, like a faraway penny. It was an incredible thing, a Nevada J6er named Matt Verdin tells me. He means the moment that Ashley was killed. He was outside when a man who said he'd been inside staggered from the building. Verdin says he could see it, the death, the meaning, the ghosts on his face. Outside the Capitol, the news spread like wildfire. Before you knew it, everybody was aware of it. This is a different situation. Verdin says that on the Capitol steps, 500 circled and held hands. Consider these spiritual numbers. Verdin says he saw more than a million souls. Law enforcement put it in the thousands. They prayed. Everybody bowed their heads and had incredible reverence for what had happened and what was going on, the shooting, the blood, the battle. To Verdin, it was peaceful. The love, hand in hand, the spirit, 1776, the dead girl. My friend Phil has given me a book to read as I travel, a novel by his daughter, Ivy Pachoda, called These Women. It keeps me company in the desert at night when I'm not driving. A California story about how women are killed and how we tell stories about these killings. Here are the ways a body can come apart, writes Pachoda. It can drown or be drowned and turn the color of a deep sea creature that has never seen the light of day. It can get trapped between the dirty, barnacled rocks and bang on them for a day or more before someone takes it away. By then, it will barely seem a body at all, but rather an obscene organism, a swollen alien form. But what are the bodies in this story? Ashley, the body of Christ, the body politic, the body of the nation. How does that body come apart? The answer is in the question I've learned to ask the believers. Do you think there'll be a civil war? They say, yes. Some say Ashley Babbitt was the first casualty. Others note January 6th as one more date in a calendar crowded with the death days of modern martyrs. All the blonde daughters of the angel families. The term used by the right for those whose loved ones have been murdered by illegals. Every cop ever killed, even close to the line of duty, except at the Capitol. Vicki Weaver, shot to death at Ruby Ridge by an FBI sniper as she cradled her 10-month-old baby when the feds came to take her white supremacist husband, Randy Weaver, away for selling sawed-off shotguns. Most of the believers express some form of sorrow for what has become, in their imaginations, the fact of this coming war. Some grow red in the cheek. The spirit of 1776, they say, you can hear the blood throb faster in their veins. In Logan, Utah, I stopped to visit an old friend, Andrew. We hadn't seen each other in 17 years. He is a present-centered man. I don't really do the past, he says. He's a scientist. He studies soil, the actual land. Also a cyclist, extreme. As I'm driving cross-country west to east, he's preparing to participate in a race up at Spine, border to border, 2,700 miles in the same 2 weeks it'll take me to drive. I'm on the horizontal. He's on the vertical. How do you do it? I ask. Trying to imagine pedaling 18 hours. Focus, he says. I don't try to think. Thoughts come in the form of flora. At Utah State, he teaches a course in plant identification. On a hike into the canyon by his home, he shows me a bright yellow flower. Dyer's woad, from which a blue dye can be extracted. One so valuable it sparked wars. Or fauna. Antelope, he says, wild horses, bears, too many bears. Sometimes he carries bear spray in place of a water bottle. Once, up north, a grizzly charged. A trucker offered him shelter in his cab. You have to take care, Andrew says. I had a name an hour south. Scott Snedden, an Air Force veteran and the founder of a local militia called American Patriot 3%. As in the 3% of the population patriots believe fought in the Revolutionary War. A number to them not dispiriting, but inspiring. If true, which it is not, it would mean it only takes 3% of a people to overthrow a regime. I found Snedden's number online because he's also a realtor. He advertises with a big dough-faced smile, pointing at you, the customer, with hands like happy six-shooters. When I called, he said, sure, he'd be glad to meet. After the bad press around January 6th, he felt it important to show the bright side of the militia movement. In Utah, he said, it's nice, community. I asked what community meant to him. Community, said Snedden, is about being prepared to take care of your own. Prepared, I ask, for whatever happens. Preppers? Yeah, he said, pleased that I followed. Doomsday? Could be, he allowed. He liked nicer terms. Love, he said, is about being ready. Thank you. Trouble in Paradise. With ironic voiceovers and swimsuit-clad cast members plucked from obscurity, the reboot of Britain's Love Island promised to be the dating show for our self-made, self-aware era. After a series of high-profile suicides, a darker reality set in. By Anna Peel. With opening illustration showing the cast by Sean McCabe. Hot Zone. Islanders from the past 7 seasons have witnessed the mercurial swing from fan love to public scrutiny. 1. Caroline Flack was the only choice to host Love Island. The C-suite wanted the Bridget Jones of TV. It has to be Caroline Flack, ITV Studios entertainment head Angela Jane told a colleague, according to someone with knowledge of the exchange. Not only because she's a great presenter, but her love life is always an effing mess. Jane disputes that characterization, but Flack, a former X Factor host who'd dated the two most famous Harrys in England, Prince and Styles, embodied the reality show's contradictions, dystopian and romantic, intimate and viewed by millions, highly produced in a way that fosters genuine human feelings. It was 2015 when Jane, whose purview includes commissioning new series, acquiring the rights to foreign hits, and publicly answering for any perceived misdeeds of ITV, set out to overhaul the tepidly received Celebrity Love Island, a 12-person British popularity contest and ostensible matchmaker that disappeared after 2 seasons. Within 36-year-old Flack as a new recruit, the network decided to reboot the show with civilians who were unguarded enough to actually find love and maybe even become Love Island-minted celebrities themselves. The plan worked. Each season, a rotating roster of a dozen or so extremely attractive UK residents are sequestered in a Majorcan villa for 8 weeks, fighting to find partners and win the hearts of the voting public under ever-watching cameras. After character introductions, in which breasts are jostled and shirts ripped off, cast members are immediately humbled. The women stand in a row in compulsory bikinis, and the men come out one by one. Any woman who fancies a man steps forward, and he chooses a mate. Sometimes no one takes a step, like a sexually humiliating version of not getting picked for dodgeball. The show is broadcast worldwide nearly in real time, with one-hour episodes airing 6 days a week during its yearly run. The 8th season arrives June 6th on the UK's ITV2, with an American premiere expected to follow a few weeks later. As this issue went to press, Hulu had yet to finalize a new deal for U.S. distribution. Challenges like a sculpting contest, in which couples try to accurately recreate the male partner's erection out of modeling clay, somehow produce connections sincere enough that people have sex and begin marrow-deep, years-long relationships on television. Like its chaste predecessor, The Bachelor, the unhinged pandemic-era successor Love is Blind, and a hollow U.S. version, Love Island serves up love stories that audiences are meant to fall in love with. It just does so better than any of its competitors. 7 years in, the show is an international BAFTA-winning phenomenon that has produced marriages, children, and enough Instagram sponcon to provide intergenerational wealth. Flack was more than just the consummate, universally known host. She's obviously been a huge part of the show's success, says Jane, speaking from London weeks before production began on season 7. What she did so uniquely and so brilliantly was she was just able to talk to all of the islanders all of the time in a way that just felt very real. She was just somebody who brought her very authentic self to work. Flack's slow-motion entrances were a harbinger of doom, letting the cast know in her creaky trill that people were about to be dumped from the villa. But when the cameras were off, Flack would stand around to encourage the contestants, perhaps because of her own acquaintance with the pains of public scrutiny. As her former colleague recounts, Caroline's endless terrible choices in boyfriends and things falling apart were all slavishly documented by British tabloids. On the season 4 premiere of Love Island, an effervescent Flack arrived with an engagement ring, which the islanders oohed over. The next season, Flack's diamond was gone. Though her success grew as the shows did, she was able to renegotiate her contract every season. At 40, her colleague says she was desperate to settle down, desperate to find the right person. It just didn't happen. I don't think she had the emotional makeup to deal with a grown-up relationship. Love Island made Flack's fame, and the attendant interest in her personal life explode. It was the perfect match. And then, Flack killed herself. For people close to her, it was a dreadful tragedy. Flack had attempted suicide after a breakup in the 90s, when she was a teenager studying theater. On Valentine's Day in 2020, after months of headline-stoking criminal proceedings surrounding a mental health issue that had been misinterpreted as a domestic assault, Flack's friend Molly Grossberg received a text. "I'm killing myself, and you don't know where I am." Grossberg and another friend, Louise Teasdale, found Flack semi-conscious and surrounded by pills. When the paramedics arrived and tried to hospitalize Flack, she refused to go, telling the EMTs that she was just stressed and trying to sleep. The following day, a little more than a week before the finale of the only Love Island season she hadn't hosted, Flack took her own life. She wasn't the first Love Island star to die by suicide. In fact, Flack was the third. Two contestants, Sophie Graydon and Mike Thalassitis, died in the previous 2 years, following endless media coverage and online harassment. After Flack's death, many people called for the show to be canceled. Aspiring contestants, 100,000 people apply each year, know the explicit premise of the series is being judged by viewers who literally vote on whether they like you. They know there will be challenges created by the show's producers to provoke them. They know they will be isolated from the outside, as the real world is called, and the feeling of insulation will make them occasionally forget that they're on the most watched show in the UK. They know things will be strategically withheld from them. According to season 6 winner Paige Turley's representative, Flack's death wasn't revealed to the cast for more than a week, until the day before the finale. Jane declined to speak on the matter. Islanders know the information they're missing will be crucial to how people view their actions. They also know that when they leave the villa, the most seemingly authentic among them will be unimaginably famous. There's a difference between intellectually understanding something and experiencing it, and the kind of vulnerability that enables fame on Love Island, on almost any reality show, often leaves people radically ill-equipped to cope with it. There have been a handful of suicides within the cast of reality programs, from The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills to Storage Wars. Many contestants on dating series experience a post-show readjustment, ranging from Bachelorette star-turned-temporary host Caitlin Bristow's recurrent depression to what Bachelor winner Vanessa Grimaldi described on her ex-fiancé Nick Viles podcast: "I would lock myself in the bathroom, just turn the shower on and cry for hours. Former Bachelor contestant Wells Adams says he was very, very raw and very vulnerable coming off the show, although he doesn't consider his reentry experience to be a bad one. He returned to Nashville and found himself rethinking a lot of my life decisions. I called every one of my exes and apologized. Now the bartender and an amateur cast therapist on Bachelor in Paradise, Adams remembers feeling compelled to make amends, even in situations where I wasn't in the wrong. His sister told him, "You came back from this a very different person." But if Love Island stands out for its immaculate, instantaneous production, it's also singular among its competitors in its darker impact. The cast has openly complained about issues of diversity. Lighting designed to boost castmates' tans left season 3 contestant Marcel Somerville looking, he says, like I was someone's shadow. And when pressed in 2019 about the narrow range of body types featured in the villa, Richard Cowles, Love Island's creator and now the managing director of Lifted Entertainment, which produces the show, responded, "Yes, we want to be as representative as possible, but we also want them to be attracted to one another." Still, the producers actually do care, Flack's colleague says. They're not just like, "We'll just do whatever to make a hit show." From the beginning of the series, ITV implemented a 2-drink-per-day maximum versus The Bachelor's 2-an-hour limit, and in 2018, the show started requiring cast members to attend a post-finale assessment with a mental health professional. Islanders are then given the option of attending 8 counseling sessions. The new 2022 duty of care protocol also mandates that prospective cast members watch a video in which executive producer Mike Spencer interviews former stars about, in ITV's words, how to cope being filmed 24/7 and dealing with social media trolling. Flack believed in Love Island for the tantalizing possibility of true love sprung from the construct of entertainment and the value of the celebrity that came with it. She used to say, "It's like meeting a superstar. When I suddenly see them come out of the green room, it's like meeting the most famous person in the world," recalls the colleague. Caroline would just go, "Oh my God, that's Molly Mae." And you're going, "Okay, you're Caroline Flack." On Sundays, Flack would watch Love Island screeners. "I'd go to her dressing room," the colleague says, "and she'd be crying because she was so invested. She said it changes people's lives." There's just one problem. There's no way to know whether a person can bear having her life changed by Love Island until that happens. 2. Would-be Islanders are sourced where you'd expect. Social media, agents, nightclubs. Essex, a county northeast of London, produces Love Island cast members with the prolificity of the Callanghan people's contributions to marathon running. One Essex stalwart is season 1 finalist John Clark, who was approached to join the series by 3 producers at a club called the Sugar Hut. "I signed the contract and I didn't even read it," Clark says of his onboarding process. That kind of naivete was dispelled as ratings rose, with cast members often drawn from the peripheries of public life. Before being recruited to the villa, season 3 finalist Olivia Atwood had a modeling contract with Monster Energy, for which she traveled with Formula One. Megan Barton Hansen earned decent money on OnlyFans, though she says ITV made her shut down her account when she joined the season 4 cast. Newcomers have arrived with still aching veneers and freshly engorged lips and breast. Even scaffolders and farmers come with rigorously sculpted abs and brows. Still, the cast are regular, not the minor celebrities of Love Island's first iteration. Whatever their aspirations, Barton Hansen recalls thinking, there are going to be fit people. I'm going to enjoy a free holiday. I'll get a bit more exposure. When civilians get caught up in filming, they lack certain self-preservational instincts. Going into this experience relatively unknown, in theory with nothing to lose, means they are relaxed enough to form actual relationships. I think we always felt that there was something magical about watching real people who don't have any particular artifice to live up to, says Jane, about the switch from already famous to pre-famous casting. In the end, I think the decision that we arrived at was completely the correct one. For the sake of high drama television, at least. What is great about the program, Jane says, is it tries to replicate what happens in real life, although it's accelerated and condensed in a period of time, and, of course, in a situation that isn't familiar to everybody. One thing most contestants aren't accustomed to is having sex in front of millions of viewers. Love Island setup, cameras rolling at every hour in every room, repositions sex on TV as a marker of quotidian courtship, not exhibitionism. Watching people slide into intimacy on screen seems to validate the realness of relationships, especially for parochial viewers who have rarely seen the acts shown or even discussed non-euphemistically on American reality programs. Barton Hansen says that to avoid being seen mid-coitus, I'd try and stay under the cover, but sometimes you've just got to pop up for air. I was so naive, and I'm such an honest and transparent person. But as long as you don't admit to having sex, they can't air it. Barton Hansen understands now that she could have kept quiet in those diary room debriefings. There were girls in my season that did have sex, but it never came out. Clark had sex on camera, under a comforter, but with verbal confirmation of the dramatic humping. The episode aired the next day. Love Island is produced so quickly by a team of hundreds that often, says an ITV employee, you'll be watching something that happened about 4 hours beforehand. When asked if he had known that intercourse would be shown, Clark says, I did and I didn't, but you gotta understand, I was a 25-year-old younger fella put in a villa. Think about it. The perfect way of meeting someone is being taken away from the world, taken away from your friends, your family, all the infiltrating parts that sometimes ruin relationships. If you spell out the ideal scenario, he says, it's big villa, pool, clothes are clean, food fed, hot girls, single guys. It's the perfect recipe to fall in love. Clark was the only cast member I spoke with who went onto the show thinking they would form a genuine romantic bond, though everyone said they wound up doing so. Four couples from the show's 7 seasons are married with children, and the winners of season 6 are still together. The same goes for 2/3 of the season 7 finalists as of press time, but that could change with the tap of the unfollow button. Hand on heart, Barton Hansen says, I didn't think I'd fall in love. I think if you're really looking for love, you won't find it. In the photo, all eyes on. As host, Caroline Flack believed in romance from mass consumption, but her own drama eventually became tabloid fodder. While shows like The Bachelor and Netflix's excellent but relatively slight first date series Dating Around manufacture romance on TV with a tone befitting the earnestness of the task, Love Island uses Ian Sterling's ironic voiceover to undercut the titular goal. The Bachelor and Paradise spinoff is hornier and less self-serious than its parent, but still so firmly of the franchise that its contestants and fans, along with those of The Bachelorette, are collectively referred to as Bachelor Nation. Sterling's commentary, delivered in a manic Scottish glissando, mocks the show, the cast, and himself. It is truly funny. It turns out, Mara has been hiding Jean-Paul Sartre's philosophical classic, Being and Nothingness, inside her copy of Heat magazine, he says, setting up a season 5 scene with cast member Mara Higgins. Am I even here? Higgins asks into the void, totally unaware of Sterling's intro. Does anyone even see that I'm here? The show disarms viewers by highlighting the ridiculousness of the proceedings, leaving us and the cast members who have heard Sterling joking through other seasons open to emotional connections we wouldn't think could develop in a communal bedroom under a neon sign that says Get Laid. Sterling's voiceover also broadcast how viewers are supposed to feel about the people we're watching, calling them out for screw-ups and questioning motivations that fans then perseverate on. In a post-monoculture world, Love Island is a rare and for 8 weeks a year near daily communal experience. The finale hasn't been taped and edited months in advance. There's no inevitable conclusion because the contestants' lives are unfolding on the same timeline as ours. Love Island creator Richard Cowles says, sounding odd, you're watching people fall in love in real time. This destabilization of the format and consequent genuineness makes us more invested in and more judgmental of the characters we're watching every night. It's also destabilizing for the people we have so many opinions about. 3. In January 2020, Love Island began filming its first ever winter edition in Cape Town. About a month before production began, on December 13th, police arrived at Flack's London apartment to investigate a domestic disturbance and found a bed soaked in her blood. Flack's boyfriend, 6'4" tennis player Lewis Burton, had a minor scratch on his head. Flack, a full foot shorter, was distraught with a large self-inflicted arm wound that would require stitches. Burton requested that prosecutors not move forward with assault charges against Flack. Her colleague says the host was clinging to the hope that she would be able to go to South Africa. It would never have worked, the colleague ventures, even if the case was dismissed. Probably they wouldn't have put her back on, because how can you put her back on? It would have made the show all about Caroline Flack. Also, she wouldn't have actually been in the right place to effing do it, to be honest with you. The charges weren't dropped after officers testified at an inquest that Flack showed no remorse at the scene and admitted, I hit him. She said she believed he was cheating on me. Within 48 hours, Flack agreed to step down from Love Island for the season. Flack's colleague says ITV agreed that if she were found not guilty, she would be back for the summer series. But Flack was flailing. She was replaced as host of Love Island by Laura Whitmore, a beautiful 34-year-old presenter who was friends with Flack and dated and eventually married Sterling, with whom Flack was also close. By court order, Flack wasn't allowed to see Burton. The tabloid headlines were brutal. Flack's bedroom bloodbath. She tried to kill me. Flack sack and whack for ITV. Though Flack had warned Islanders not to read negative things about themselves online, she was obsessed with her own deluge of terrible news coverage. She couldn't follow her own advice, her colleague says. Worst advice ever is just tell Caroline not to pay attention to what people are saying. This girl is half woman, half phone. I mean, there is no way she's not going to look at it, because it's human nature. When she died, Flack had no role on the show she had become synonymous with. No producing credits to pave a new way forward. No contact with the man she loved. No confidence that she would escape what she felt were unjust criminal charges, and no press but bad press. Sophie Graydon also found the public's intrusions impossible to escape. On Love Island Season 2, the model and former Miss Great Britain was partnered with Tom Powell before coupling with Katie Salmon in the show's first same-sex pairing. Though Graydon was a sensitive presence in the villa, frequently brought to tears by the distress of her castmates, the move was viewed as cynical gameplay by some viewers, who started aggressively attacking Graydon online. "No one anticipated Love Island's success," Graydon said in March 2018, nearly 2 years after her departure. "We became public property overnight, and everyone had an opinion, both good and bad." "On leaving the show, I descended into quite a dark, dark place, owing to the amount of negativity focused towards me. There were positives and some lovely people, but I would always let the negatives outweigh the positives. I started to believe what these people were saying about me was true." Months later, on June 20, 2018, Graydon died by suicide. Her boyfriend, Aaron Armstrong, killed himself 20 days later. Before joining Season 3 of Love Island in 2017, Mike Thelasidis was a professional footballer. While on the show, he earned the nickname Muggy Mike after committing the behavioral misdemeanor of flirting with another Islander's partner. To mug someone off is to be disrespectful. The result was akin to being called Jerky Jerry in nearly every press mention. Shortly after he left the villa, the supermarket chain Tesco released a line of mugs that brandished the name alongside his face. Thelasidis, while seemingly sanguine about it at the time, hadn't trademarked the phrase and made no money from the cup sale. His post-show aspirations were implied by brand-tagged Instagram post and the announcement of an Essex restaurant he planned to open with a friend. But Thelasidis killed himself in a London park on March 16, 2019, after writing in a journal his intention that his life should come to an end, according to the coroner. To announce his death, some headlines even used the Love Island nickname he couldn't escape. A few weeks later, Thelasidis' business partner debuted The Skillet without him, though the restaurant didn't last the year. When I asked Thelasidis' castmate Marcel Somerville whether contestants have responsibility for the reputation they help shape with their on-screen role, or whether the show has culpability for making that persona into a storyline, he tells me it's the wrong question. "Each decision on Love Island precipitates the next, but it's less the divine intricacy of a Rube Goldberg machine than the random spatter of chaos theory." For Thelasidis, financial difficulty and diminished social status may have followed the relentless negative press prompted by the nickname coined by a fellow Islander and adapted by a narrator. But what has consequence is up to chance. As Somerville says, it's a conversation that happened and the show aired it, and then it just spun off into its own thing. If the relationships on Love Island make us believe the performance of love leads to the real deal, the losses, it feels shameful to say, seem to authenticate the depth of human experience. Karen Hornick, Ph.D., a clinical associate professor at New York University who teaches culture, literature, and philosophy, puts it this way: there's nothing more real than dying. 4. Planning how you will be received on Love Island is out of the question. It's impossible to even map out how you will behave. If you did have a game plan, Barton Hansen, the Season 4 finalist, says, the producers are going to try and throw a spanner in the works. These derailments include the widely understood reality tools of selective editing and off-screen encouragement to engage in conflict, along with efforts to break up couples with cast changes. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.